as Ted Cruz surges. It's Donald Trump's words that will take center stage at the GOP debate in Las Vegas tomorrow night. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. Just ahead, we'll take your calls on the GOP debate, Donald Trump's impact in 2016. Where do you stand? Give us a call now, 549-2937, to join the show. Then later, First Coast Success profiles Jerry Malott of the JAX USA Partnership, leading economic development efforts for the entire Northeast Florida region, plus Cole Pepper as the Jaguars pull one out against the Colts. All of that ahead this hour. But first this morning, the stage is set for the final GOP debate of the year. It'll be on CNN, broadcasting live from Las Vegas tomorrow night. And the political hurricane over frontrunner Donald Trump's comments on a Muslim ban in this country is only expected to grow stronger. We've got a preview of what we might expect as we welcome Professors Matt Corrigan and Parvez Ahmed, both with the University of North Florida, and they join us now in studio. Good to see you both, gentlemen.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning, Melissa, and welcome back.
Thank you so much. And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to Donald Trump's call for a Muslim ban? What do you think about the chatter that the Republicans might look to do a brokered convention in 2016? Give us a call with your thoughts about the 2016 presidential race, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. You can email and tweet the show or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so, Matt, the final debate of the year, as Ted Cruz seems to be gaining strength in Iowa, it is still Donald Trump's comments about a ban on Muslims entering this country that have roiled the Republican Party. And now we're hearing word that top party leaders in Washington are discussing at the highest levels, figuring out if there's a chance of a brokered convention. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think his comments basically just put a hand grenade into the whole political process. Before we go further, I do want to say welcome back and what a great job you did in Washington.
Thank you.
You made everyone proud. What I think he's done is made an appeal, Americans who are angry at a lot of things. And I think it's probably the most divisive campaign since George Wallace. And so I think it's a real problem for the Republican Party. And what he did, I think there is one positive out of those comments, is I think it's probably woken up other Republicans to say, you know, we can't do this. I mean, if Donald Trump becomes the nominee, Secretary Clinton's going to win probably pretty easily.
Do you think this talk of a brokered convention is based in reality? We've heard this chatter off and on through the years, but there hasn't been a brokered convention for either major party in more than half a century.
Yeah, I think we don't know. If anyone like me tells you, exactly what's going to happen in February in these primaries and caucuses, take caution. Because unlike general elections, primary and caucuses tend to be very unpredictable up to the last moment. So I don't think we know that yet. The chances of it are higher than they usually are because you have proportional representation, which is a fancy way of saying they split up the delegates really up until mid-March. That's when states can become winner-take-all. And so we may not have a clear picture until March or April, and so the chances of a brokered convention are higher. And if Trump stays such an important figure throughout this, then I think they're even higher.
What do you think of Donald Trump's call for a Muslim ban in this country? Give us a call with your thoughts at 549-2937. Parvez Ahmed, what are your thoughts about critics not only of Donald Trump, but the GOP, some leaders of the GOP distancing themselves from Donald Trump? Critics saying that, in a sense, the GOP has brought this tempest upon themselves, Democrats would say anyway, by pandering to xenophobic elements within the party.
Well, I want to echo what Matt said. Welcome back, and what a great job you did. You made all of us proud in Washington.
Thank you.
First of all, the problem is not Donald Trump alone, because many other Republican presidential candidates, including Ted Cruz, who is leading in Iowa, have said things that are very similar to Donald Trump. And I think what they're all reflecting is a strain within the Republican Party, among Republican voters, that is quite alarming. A recent poll showed that, I'm going to read some of this over here, 32% of Republicans think that Islam is inherently violent, compared to almost half of that in 17% of Democrats. 43% of Republicans feel that the government should monitor most Muslims. 46% of Republicans think that majority of Muslims support ISIS. 54% of Republicans think that they would not vote for a Muslim presidential candidate. So you see that there is a deep-seated anti-Muslim feeling that is permeating across a lot of Republican voters. And Donald Trump, and that has existed for actually quite a while. And what Donald Trump has done, he has given voice to that strain of thought.
Matt Corrigan, going beyond the issue of Muslims in this country, what are your thoughts, too, about how Donald Trump is perhaps exploiting a division in the GOP between the so-called establishment and the rank and file, angry at party leaders who they believe habitually maneuver to block true conservatives from leading the party?
Yeah, I think it might be a little bit more complicated than that establishment just versus the rank and file. I think what Trump is doing is perhaps expanding the electorate. Now, we'll see if some of these people who are answering the polls are actually going to show up. But you do have those who are non-college educated, who are making up a good percentage of Trump supporters, and who are so disillusioned with the process that, again, I think he's speaking to that and maybe in some ways scared of the changes that are happening in our country, both demographically and economically. And so the question is, will those supporters show up? Polling is very difficult. Everyone take a deep breath. It is very difficult these days. So some of these polls are way off. But there's no doubt about that Trump has hit a nerve. And he's going to be a factor.
Grievances ranging from concern over changing demographics, Parviz Ahmed, to anger over jobs being outsourced overseas, to the middle class being hollowed out. Of course, the two parties differ on solutions to that, differ greatly. But that huge swath of voters, as Matt mentioned, particularly white voters who don't have a college degree, are incredibly angry.
That's true. I mean, there is anger, and the anger is real, and the issues are real. But what is happening, particularly by Trump and many other Republican candidates, is they're taking real issues, obfuscating the reality of those issues, and wrapping those issues in hyperbolic comments, which really do not have any practical value. The idea that somebody can build a wall on the southern borders of the U.S. is just not going to happen, at least not going to happen in the way it is being proposed and the way he's rallying the troops. The idea that you could ban all Muslims coming to this country is just not going to happen. By the way, if we go through with this idea, we will become the only country in the world that has banned a people from a particular religion from entering that country. So is that the kind of American exceptionalism we want to promote? I don't think so. But it undermines our values. It shows the world that we are an intolerant nation. We are afraid. And in our fears, we are willing to lash out against a vulnerable minority.
Matt Corrigan, at the same time, Donald Trump is expected to get a lot of attention tomorrow night. John Podesta, helping to chair the campaign of Hillary Clinton, told a group of top Democrats the other day that the Clinton campaign feels Ted Cruz is going to be the Republican nominee. Do you agree?
I don't think I'm going to make any predictions this early because there's going to be a lot that happens in the next month and a half. I do think Cruz is positioned well, and the reason is I think he does well in Iowa. Whether he wins or not, I don't know, but I think he does well. The idea that Donald Trump gets a lot of evangelical support is surprising to me, just because I think if someone put together a targeted campaign on that issue, I mean, with his history, he has gone on the Howard Stern show and talked about his, you know, sex life and things like that. I just don't think that's going to hold up. So I think Cruz is positioned pretty well in Iowa. And he also has an organization in the southern states. I'm not sure Cruz does that well in New Hampshire, but in the south, he looks pretty strong. And so, yeah, he's going to be a major factor. And, you know, what I think that might scare the Republican establishment even more than Trump, because Cruz knows how to play the game and Trump doesn't. And Cruz is very, very conservative.
And let's go to your calls and comments right now. What do you think about Donald Trump's call for a Muslim ban in this country? What are your thoughts about the presidential race, the GOP field? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. Steve is along I-95. Hello, Steve. Thanks for holding and good morning. All right, Steve, give us a call back to Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning. I hope that you would finish that statement about a ban after verification. It wasn't a total ban, per se. But I am considering myself a college graduate, member of the intelligentsia, and he speaks to my feelings, Mr. Trump, not yet to my brain. But if he gets to that point, then he's got my vote. Also want to remind those who attend the debate, the non-college graduate, that the majority of these people are not college graduates.
So will you be voting for Donald Trump? Are you a Republican? Are you registered to vote in the primary?
I'm a progressive Republican of, you know, the Lincoln / Roosevelt group. And let me also add, Hillary doesn't have a slam dunk on this. As a matter of fact, the one guy she could lose to is Donald Trump. If she runs against a guy who's kind of like her, a girl, then she would win. But he offers this thing different, I think.
So have you decided yet, Bill, when the primary comes to Florida in March, who'll get your vote?
Well, we've got to wait till then. If he starts speaking to my brain, the answer is a definite strong yes.
Thanks for the call, Bill. Parvez Ahmed.
Well, that's exactly what the point is. The caller articulates the point very, very well. He's speaking to the fears of people, but he does not have a plan. And until he has a plan, it remains to be seen how voters would react once he actually puts out some ideas that go with some of the ridiculous proposals that he has floated out there. In other words, how would he ban Muslims from coming to this country? And what would that ban look like? Like somebody will ask at the airport, are you a Muslim? And what if an ISIS guy comes in and says, I'm not a Muslim, so he gets to enter. And a guy who answers honestly said, I'm a Muslim, he's turned back. Are we going to turn back people from the airport? I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
How would you do such a thing? And Matt Corgan, what did you think about Bill's point of view that Donald Trump would easily beat Hillary Clinton?
I just don't see that. You know, I think the caller was expressing, and I appreciate his honesty for saying, you know, Trump speaking to his fears. And he also makes a great point about our citizens who don't have a college degree. We weren't speaking down about them. We were just making a point about demographics. You know, with Trump's original proposal, as I read it, somebody like Shad Khan, who had left the country, would not have been able to come back in. What Trump has done is he makes these outlandish statements, and then he kind of walks them back slowly. And, you know, that's just not going to work over the long term. But clearly what the caller's talking about is people are concerned about terrorism. It is a valid concern. And what we need now is leadership who deal with terrorism, but also not get into really race baiting. And that's a challenging balance, but one that has to be really put together.
Parvez Ahmed, what are your thoughts about on the Republican side, critics who might say, I don't like Donald Trump's comments. I do see them as offensive, but I don't believe the president has led well on this issue.
I mean, there's certainly a critique that is legitimate about how the president has handled the issue of terrorism or the foreign policy challenge of Syria. But also we have to temper all of these conversations with the realism. And I think that's where we are missing a lot in the public discourse. For example, since 1980, 94% of terrorist attacks in the United States have been conducted by people who are not Muslims. This year alone, we have had well over 350 mass shootings, with 462 dead and well over 1,000 people injured. Only two of these mass shootings, including the one in San Bernardino, was conducted by a Muslim. We often hear this refrain that not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims. But that's not true either. you know, whether it's in Europe, where a vast majority of terrorist acts are conducted by people who are not Muslims. We see this in Southeast Asia, where there are Buddhist terrorists. And even in this country, the FBI looked at terrorism committed in the U.S. soil between 1980 to 2005, and as I mentioned, 94% were not conducted by Muslims. In 2014, a study by University of North Carolina found that since 9/11, Muslim-linked terrorism has claimed 37 American lives. In that same period, we had 190,000 Americans murdered. These are the facts. But in this time, during this polarized time, and the extreme frenzy and the hype that we see in the media, It appears to me that facts just do not register. Facts do not matter. People are just leading by emotion and passion, and there is complete absence of recognition of what the facts on the ground are.
To Ricky and Murray Hill. Hello, Ricky. Good morning.
Good morning. I enjoy your show.
Thanks.
And, yes, ma'am, and thanks. You did a good job wherever you were. Everybody keeps commenting on it.
Thanks. It was Washington. Thank you.
Yeah, I've met you before. You're a very professional lady. I look at this thing as a couple of things, like from a paranoia point of view. I remember there were some Jewish people who tried to get in the country back when Hitler was doing something, and they refused to let them in on a ship down there in Miami somewhere and sent them back. And a lot of them, I saw a guy on TV said a lot of them got killed. And this seems like just the same thing, you know, over again. It's like a paranoia. It has to do with economics and, you know, a couple of variables. But I just want to say this. My mother was talking about it, and most people in my family was talking about it over the holidays. It's like sort of like Donald Trump is sort of like a Hitler type of guy, you know? I mean, what he's spewing is to like a one set of peoples, but it's really can take over the whole country, you know, as far as fear and stuff like that.
Ricky, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Ricky. And he's talking about the ship, the St. Louis, I believe, in 1939 that President Roosevelt turned away. Some of the Jews on that ship did die in the Holocaust. Matt.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to go down that road again. And that's why I think, you know, Trump's comments are dangerous, because it really enters into a conversation that you really don't want to go down. And, you know, we've had problems in this country before with race relations. We continue to have problems, and we don't want to add fuel to that fire. And I think what's going to be interesting, can somebody in the so-called establishment lane make that argument to the Republican Party that you can be vigilant about terrorism, verification and visas and all that, but still be true to American values?
How does the GOP, Parvez, keep the Trump coalition and the so-called mainstream moderate coalition together after the primaries, given that there is so much anger and division over these issues?
I will quote a GOP leader, and I'm not a big fan of Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina for many of the issues where he stands. But I have to commend him for saying something so remarkable during these times. And I'm paraphrasing over here when he said that losing an election is not the end of the world. There are far worse things that can happen than losing an election. Saving the country is more important than winning an election. And so if you think about where we stand right now as a nation, after San Bernardino, Google just released this report. After San Bernardino, the top search term in the Google search engine was kill Muslims in California. And nationwide, people searched the term kill Muslims with the same frequency that they searched for the Cowboys roster. It's scary. As you know, since Paris and San Bernardino, there has been well over 60 Islamophobic attacks. Huffington Post and Daily Beast have been doing a running tally of all of the Islamophobic attacks. And some of them are extremely concerning. KKK flyers in Alabama said they were recruiting people to stop, quote unquote, the spread of Islam. Rocks were thrown through windows of a Muslim family home. Women A Somali restaurant was set on fire. A bloody pig's head was left inside or thrown inside a mosque. A store owner was beaten in Queens. Mosques are receiving threatening phone calls. A Muslim taxi driver was shot by a passenger. And the list goes on and on and on. This morning, New York Times did a story that Muslim children in this country are facing the same psychological trauma that Japanese children faced during World War II. We are slipping back, we are already in that territory where we are going back to the dark times of our society back in the 50s and 40s and 60s. I think it is time for Republican leaders to step forward. It is time for faith leaders to step forward. It is time for Americans of conscience to step forward and say enough is enough. This is 2015. We cannot live in fear. We are the nation where our creed is the land of the free and the home of the brave. This is not bravery when we cower for fear under the threat of deranged killers. They are killers and they are a threat, but we must have a realistic assessment of that threat.
Jack in Arlington. Hi, Jack. Thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. I really think that Trump should be the main guy for the Republicans, so Hillary can come right in and knock him right off his feet and take the presidency. I think it's great. I think she won't have any problems. Trump is their man.
Jack, thanks. Matt Corrigan.
That's probably right. And keep in mind that general elections, are really a 5 percentage point difference, where you're really talking about trying to persuade those who are persuadable. So, Trump, if he got the nomination, I mean, he'd poll in the 40s, in the general election. He'd be competitive, but I just don't think, especially if Trump is the nominee, Republicans can probably write off Florida with its strong number of Hispanic voters, Hispanic Republican voters, by the way, as well.
You think they'll go for Hillary Clinton, if she's the nominee?
Yeah, I don't think you're going to see a lot of support among the Hispanic community here in Florida, and that's a huge vote. And so, if you're just looking at the raw politics, Clinton should win that. But again, I'm not sure the country wants to get to that point where you've got that choice.
Steve is along I-10. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Hi, fine, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. And first of all, I'd like to say that I'm a dual citizen. I'm Canadian and American, and all my family is up in Canada and my wife's family. And I would like to offer to you just one quick little point. Canadians are very comfortable taking Syrian refugees in because we don't have the NRA in Canada. And we also have, Canadians have no access to AK-47s and AR-17s. So if some fellow or whatever, or whomever, decides to get radicalized in Canada, they're not going to do any damage. The most they can do is pick up a shotgun or something like that and shoot a few people. Whereas in the United States, of course, you can go to Walmart, pick up an AK-47, and do all kinds of damage. That's the only point I wanted to make.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, the Canadians have really shown the way over here. I do not know if you saw the videos of and the stories of the Canadian Prime Minister, the newly elected Canadian Prime Minister, who was at the airport receiving Syrian refugees, and he was personally handing clothes. It was a very touching gesture, not just a political statement, but it's just a human face to the tragedy. And I think our political leaders have to emulate that high standard that the Canadians have set for us.
In recent days, the issue of Syrian refugees has sort of faded, Matt. Now the discussion is moving on to other matters like the visa waiver program, but still with this idea of limiting people coming into this country on the Republican side.
Yeah, the refugee program is one of the most heavily vetted programs that we have. And so it was ironic that was the call for stricter guidelines. Listen, doing this vetting is difficult work, especially if people, don't have, papers and things like that. So, again, all of that has to be looked at. There's no question about that. And this is going to be difficult to do. But again, you enter that conversation by still being true to the Constitution.
Jim in Fernandina Beach. Hi, Jim. What are your thoughts?
Well, I want to kind of disagree with some of the information and survey feedback. And to me, the biggest issue that we've got is whether we like it or not, America is really a marketing-oriented country, and we really have very little knowledge, the general public, about Muslims, about the Muslim religion, what they stand for, what their organization is. And unfortunately, the Muslim community in the United States, maybe even worldwide, is doing their faith a very, very great disservice by not standing up and saying things.
Jim, thanks. Muslim leaders have condemned the attacks this most recent round, but and that's been ongoing. You, Parvez Ahmed, have done so many, many times, including on this program. What would you say, though, to the other day when the president spoke about this issue from the Oval Office? He condemned these xenophobic narratives coming from Donald Trump and others, but at the same time, he said that the Muslim community needed to confront the ranks of extremism within its own community. What are your thoughts?
I think he was right on both counts. I think the xenophobia that is coming out from Donald Trump and many of the other Republican candidates need to be condemned, need to be resisted. I'll just give you another polling data. Wall Street Journal, NBC did a poll, and they found that Donald Trump is less popular in the U.S. than Muslims are. And that's saying a lot right now, because Muslims are a disfavored and unpopular community in this country. And the caller over here just reflects this. You know, if somebody wants to learn about the American Muslim community, they can walk into a mosque and learn about it. They can reach out to Muslim American groups or Muslim American citizens and have a chat with them. It's not that the Muslim Americans live in this country in any big secret. They are doctors, they're engineers, they're professors, they're teachers, they're husbands and wives and raising a family. They are your neighbors. So instead of being suspicious about what the Muslims do, I do not know who the Muslims is. You know, they're a community just like individuals are. And just reach out to them, have a chat with them, and maybe some of your fears will be, you can overcome some of your fears. On the other point, that it is absolutely right that the Muslim community, whether here or abroad, can do a better job. But that job cannot be done if the community is constantly under threat and suspicion. It cannot be done if it is not supported by law enforcement. It cannot be done if our political leaders don't stand beside them. So yes, they can do more, but it has to be done in a partnership. And we need every American to stand at this time beside the Muslim community.
Mitchell is in Palatka. Hi, Mitchell. Good morning.
Yes, this is an interesting subject. I'm a Republican, and of course I do support allowing these threatened people to come to the country. I realize that there can be danger, but life has got risks. The thing is, I've been saying it for years, that the way to deal with the terrorist problem is that once you get your hands on the bodies of a dead terrorist, and you can identify them as a Islamic terrorist, those bodies should be cooked, and then they should be fed to pigs. This would take all the romance out of being a terrorist. And whenever people realize that if all they have to do is get themselves shot and they're going to be eaten by pigs, then they'll think, you know, I don't think I want to be a terrorist anymore.
All right, Mitchell. That has got to be the most unique solution we've heard yet on this program.
Indeed.
To this issue. Let's go now to Danny in Arlington. Hey, Danny, good morning.
Hi there. I just wanted to ask a quick question of your knowledgeable guests today. Why is the national mainstream media ignoring Bernie Sanders? And why is it always assumed that Hillary is the default nominee for the Democrats? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Thanks, Danny. Matt?
It's a great question, and we go back to these polls. Actually, Bernie Sanders polls higher than Donald Trump.
In a general election matchup.
Well, even right? among Democrats in many polls, you know, Sanders will be in the mid-30s and Trump is in the mid-20s with Republicans, but Trump gets all the publicity. And so it's a really good question. I think the other day there was analysis of network news There was about 80 stories over the last month about Donald Trump and one story about Bernie Sanders. So it's a legitimate point.
We've talked about that, the Sanders campaign. We can talk about it right now. His issues of income inequality have faded a little bit from the national media headlines, Parvez, due to so much discussion of terrorism, particularly in the wake of the attacks in San Bernardino. But the issues of income inequality continue to be of concern to voters when they look at domestic issues.
Let me put on my hat as an economist and say that income inequality and climate change are the two biggest issues that will confront us, not just now, but for generations to come. And so Bernie Sanders has been very effective in raising the profile of both of these issues, and they will become prominent issues both in the Democratic primary as well as going forward in the general election.
Lisa in St. Augustine. Hi, Lisa. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad they gave you back from Washington. I was afraid they were going to keep you. I thought you did a fabulous job. One thing that there's so many points I would love to say, but the thing that really strikes me with Donald is his supporters are talking about his business acumen and that kind of thing. He doesn't seem to be a person who does, he shows poor decision making just in the way that he is shooting himself in the foot in business terms. With his comments about the Mexican immigrants, he lost a lot of some serious, made a big impact on his business at that point. I know the more recent things that he's been saying about Muslims. He's got the big development over in Dubai and with these million-dollar houses that he's trying to sell over there. And, you know, that's kind of going down the tubes because of the comments he's made. So if we're saying that shows he's a bad business person if he can't even kind of dial it back in order to maintain his own interests and poor decision making in that regard. And then we're going to let him, take over in a larger macro sense and use that same strategy in running the country when he is putting us at risk in our reputation in the world with everybody thinking that we're ignorant and hateful, and then locally ostracizing the Muslims that we need to keep us safe by sharing information when they do feel that somebody is radicalizing.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for the call. Speaking of the local community, Stephanie emails the show, what are ways we in Jacksonville can help and support the local Muslim community to ensure that they do feel welcome?
Well, that's a great question. I'll answer that question in a moment. I want to address what the caller was saying about the economic issues. I think I want to appeal to our listeners and my American friends and neighbors that if you don't care about the moral issue of what Donald Trump is speaking about, whether building a wall or preventing Mexicans from coming into the country or Muslims coming into the country or going after women or disabled people, if you don't care about the morality of the issue, think about the pocketbook issue over here. The idea that you can have Mexico pay for the wall has not been really thought through in a way that what would that provoke in terms of U.S. exports to Mexico? What kind of retaliation would Mexico then engage in? The same question, when you prevent Muslims from coming into this country as immigrants or as business people, what kind of backlash does it generate for Americans doing business in those countries? So ultimately, if you don't care about the morality of the issue, think about the pocketbook that those policies would hurt. Now to the emailer's question about what can local people do to support the Muslim community. First and foremost, be educated about the issue. Know who your Muslim American neighbors are. There are several mosques in this city. You can walk into them. You can meet people there. You can engage with interfaith groups like One Jax or Atlantic Institute of Jacksonville. These are many groups, civic groups over here that are doing good work. Engage with them, attend their programs, meet people, and learn about your community members.
And with all of that said, Matt Corgan, your final thoughts as we look ahead to the next debate in this contest.
Yeah, the debate, again, you always say that's the most important, but it's going to be a big one, because it's the last one before the holidays where people probably tune out for a little bit. I think Trump will be on the defensive a bit. He doesn't do as well in the debate format. The question is, can someone else rise besides Trump or Cruz? Is it Bush? Is it Rubio? Is it Christie? Who's going to be that alternative?
Always great to see you both. Thanks for joining us with your analysis.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Parvez Ahmed and Matt Corrigan, both professors at the University of North Florida this morning. And later, Culpepper with sports as the Jags win in record style against the Colts. But up next, today's edition of First Coast Success as our Karen Mathis speaks with Jerry Mellott of Jacks USA. Back in a moment.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, as president of Jacks USA Partnership and executive vice president of the Jacks Chamber, he's a local business leader who oversees strategy for economic development across Northeast Florida. In today's edition of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Financial News and Daily Record speaks with Jerry Mellott.
Any economic development deal done in Jacksonville for the past 22 years no doubt involved one man in particular, Jerry Mellott. Mellott joined the Jacks Chamber on New Year's Day 1994. His role as executive vice president of Jacks Chamber and also president of the Jacks USA Partnership puts him in the center of job creation. Among the projects completed under his watch are Fidelity National Financial Corporation, Pilot Pen Corporation, Deutsche Bank, Merrill Lynch, and GE Oil and Gas, to name a few. Those who work with him say he's effective because he's smart and humble. Jerry Mellott, welcome to First Coast Success.
Glad to be with you, Karen.
As you reach your 22nd year in Jacksonville, what deal stands out the most for you and why?
Well, I think it's pretty easy. There have been some wonderful projects for our community and our region, but I think the impact of Fidelity National Financial is so enormous that it's hard to say that wouldn't be the most important one. You know, it was a Fortune 500 company. We were fortunate in that they had just purchased a company here, which allowed them to sort of discover Jacksonville at a time when they were having a lot of difficulty in California. And frankly, the business was growing more on the East Coast. So it gave us an opportunity to go forward. But their impact here has been tremendous. We now, because of them, have two Fortune 500 headquarters here and a third very substantial firm with Black Knight. You know, very high salaries and enormous impact on charitable giving and other things in the community. So that would have to be number one.
Well, you're obviously quite skilled in working with elected officials and with city, state, and federal agencies. And for example, you've worked with, I believe, four mayors and their administrations, dozens of city council members, as well as state elected officials. How do you effectively navigate the changes in the goals and the priorities across administrations over so many years?
Well, the good news, and one of the reasons I came here, I really became convinced in the process of looking at this opportunity that this is a community and a region that embraces growth and opportunity and creation of jobs. And I have not found a significant variance from administration to administration on how to go about the process and their support of that. And, you know, I'm not really very comfortable with politics per se, but we really try to deal in facts and opportunities and how do we make things happen. And every mayor, every administration, you know, wants those things as well. So it hasn't really been difficult. I do try to, again, stay out of the politics part of it, but we're blessed with some wonderful community leaders who have a relatively common vision, and economic development is all part of that.
Well, you've been working in economic development your entire career, I believe, starting in 1970 in mm-hmm. Wichita. What motivates you?
Well, you know, I got into this business by total accident. But what I found was this is one of the most exciting things that anybody can do, to be able to work with so many wonderful people, to be able to impact communities in such a significant way, to deal with top corporate executives around the world and their decision-making process and their strategy. I mean, we really get into the strategy of individual companies with them to try to help them believe that this is the right opportunity for them. So I can't think of anything more exciting and enjoyable to do, and it's not at all hard to be motivated.
What brought you to Jacksonville?
I had been in Wichita a lot of my life, and I had an opportunity to go to Tampa, and I liked it. And within a couple of years, a recruiter had asked me to consider coming to Jacksonville, which I thought was crazy at the time. But they finally convinced me to come up here and at least sit down and visit and talk about economic development. And I discovered a new city that I didn't know anything about. I'd never been here. And I thought, why does nobody know about this city? Well, that was occurring at the same time the Jaguars were about to be named as Jacksonville's new team, which I didn't believe would happen, by the way. But it did, and that just cemented the deal. And so it was kind of like getting a fresh opportunity. I mean, all of a sudden, Jacksonville was a billboard for the whole country on this community that's getting an NFL team. And it has been a wonderful experience since that time. But I would tell you the Jaguars played a huge role in how we've been able to launch and be discovered by so many people around the world.
And that's because of the name recognition?
It is. It is. It's of course, we also got off to a good start. And there are many other things like the players and other things that help do that. But particularly in this country, the Jaguars put us on the map and made people think, I don't know a lot about Jacksonville. Maybe we ought to take a look. And when they take a look, they're going to find that the quality of our region and the characteristics, cost, workforce, and other things are so good that we most of the time end up on the short list of consideration, and we probably win more than our share.
When companies look at Jacksonville, how do they choose the location within the city? And that leads to the next question of what is the status of downtown in attracting jobs?
First, they don't just look at Jacksonville. They look at the whole region, and it's often driven by the characteristics they give us when they say we're going to look at your area. Many of the things that drive it are existing available buildings, though, and that actually makes it more difficult for some of the other counties that might not have existing available space that meets their needs. But companies give us the criteria. We try to match with what our assets and resources are here as we're responding over a period of weeks and often more likely months. Generally, it's going to be 6 months or so. You know, it's funny. There's been a pretty important shift on the downtown issue. For the longest time, companies wanted only to look at suburban options. And we have a lot of good suburban options as well. Parking is one of those reasons, and a perception about downtowns in general that are not always very positive. But that has changed. Downtowns are now becoming a real important place to go, a lot because a lot of young people want to live downtown and live in lofts or areas that they believe are cool. And in our own downtown, we're getting lots of activity. There are a lot of restaurants and bars being developed and different alternatives. So if the workforce is moving more downtown, companies want to be more downtown now. It's cool to be downtown again. And that's a great thing because I think that's going to help really make our downtown go over the next 5 to 10 years.
You've held a lot of leadership positions. And what is your leadership style?
I think it's very collaborative. I want input from whether it's my team or our partners around the way. But I have a strong sense of urgency and a real requirement for follow-through. I mean, I just think that you're only relevant if you can do things quickly and follow through and make sure they really happen. One really important thing is to surround myself with people who are smart and excited and good at what they do. And that's been a blessing for me. I've had that opportunity going forward, really throughout my career. That makes all the difference.
Well, Jerry Mellott, president of the JAX USA Partnership, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thanks, Karen. Glad to be here.
And in a moment, Cole Pepper as the Jags win in record style.
Today's First Coast Success was brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater. What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
Welcome back. Well, this evening's performance today here on 89.9 will feature the St. Augustine Music Festival's St. Augustine Suite for Chamber Orchestra. The piece is composed by Pyotr Chevchik, whose name you probably recognize as the composer and performer of our own First Coast Connect theme. You can hear Pyotr's St. Augustine Suite for Chamber Orchestra tonight on Performance Today, beginning at 7 p.m. right here on 89.9 WJCT, his national debut. Well, finally this hour, the Jaguars win in record style against the Colts.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
The most points scored in a regular season game, Culpepper is here to break it down for us. Pretty exciting. Good morning.
51-6.
How about that? Finally.
That was a remarkable game for the Jaguars. Really, it wasn't a remarkable game. It was a remarkable half. The first half, at least the first 28 minutes, was pretty dull. I mean, there was more kicking in that game than you see in a lot of Armada matches. I mean, it was really a bad first half for both teams. Then the Jaguars really turned it on, scored 42 in the second half. The only time in Jaguars history they've scored more points in a game was that 62-point explosion against the Miami Dolphins in the playoffs back in the 1999 season. It happened in January of 2000. The Jaguars also scored points, scored touchdowns on offense, defense, and special teams in the same game for the first time since 2011. Three more touchdowns for Blake Bortles, who now has 30, the first Jaguars quarterback to reach that plateau. He's third in the NFL in touchdown passes for a quarterback.
Nice.
Behind Tom Brady and Carson Palmer. So,
wow.
Yeah, not too bad.
Not at all.
Of company to be in. Jaguars are now 5-8 with three games to play. Next week they host Atlanta, who are absolutely tanking right now. So a chance for a win there. Then it's New Orleans. Tough to win in New Orleans, but not unforeseeable. Then Houston. So if the Jaguars can win a couple of these the next two games, that third game against Houston is a chance that it could actually be a game maybe for the division championship. Texans lost to the Patriots last night. So January 3rd, I mean, we've been wanting so long for the Jaguars to be playing significant games after Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
They could actually be playing a significant game after New Year's Day,
plays out right. Let's hope so. Wouldn't that be great? Meanwhile, a local favorite, Yulee High School alum Derrick Henry, winning the Heisman Trophy.
Yeah, he becomes the second local player to win the Heisman, joining Tim Tebow, of course. Fairly close voting. He beat out Stanford running back Christian McCaffrey and Clemson quarterback Deshaun Watson. And just a quick story here on Derrick Henry. As happens so often with young star football players and other sports, but also football especially, there were a lot of schools that wanted him to come play high school football, not just being recruited to the next level, but there are a lot of, hey, why don't you come here, play for this team, play for that team. But he's from Yulee. He grew up there, and he wanted to play with his friends. Mm-hmm. And so he did. He goes to Yulee High School and becomes the all-time leading rusher in high school football history anywhere, not just in the state of Florida, anywhere.
Right.
And then goes to Alabama and winds up doing what he's done and has had a tremendous year. Obviously, you win the Heisman Trophy. He has a chance to have an even better year with Alabama because they're in the college football playoff, a chance to maybe win a national championship again. So he was the first running back to win the award since another Alabama running back, Mark Ingram, won it back in 2009. And great to see a local kid who, by all accounts, really did things the right way.
Wow. Congrats to him. That's so exciting. And you know what? It's a little sad to say that this is our last Culpepper segment of 2015.
I know it.
Can you believe it?
It seems like just yesterday we were starting the year.
I know. We are closing out the year, but you want to close things out on a strong note with a look ahead to 2016.
Yeah, three stories I just wanted to touch on that I think will have an impact on what we talk about with regard to sports in 2016. We know the Jaguars. I think what that story is going to be is still yet to be determined by what happens the rest of this year. But 2016 will be the first season for the Jacksonville Suns under new owner Ken Babby. Younger energy, a guy who's owned another minor league team, and some changes and improvements, I think, are going to be on the way for what the Suns do as far as their game day activities and how they do business. Story two, a new coach for the Jacksonville Armada, Tony Meola, the three-time World Cup goalkeeper for the United States and a guy who has unbelievable contact. I had a couple conversations with Tony already. Unbelievable contacts around the world of soccer and a guy who was the MVP of the MLS, the only goalkeeper to ever do that. So he's got some amazing context and perspective, and how that's going to impact not only the roster makeup of the Armada, but the product that's put out there on the field, I think is going to be something to follow. First year for the Armada was a smashing success in terms of fan attendance and corporate partnership and so forth. The team didn't perform on the field, particularly on the road, like they would like. I mean, that's really the charge for Tony Meola, is to get them over the hump and win games on the road, play as well on the road as they did at home. And then finally, got to have a little fun with this one. In February, Melissa, the national championship in curling is coming to Jacksonville.
Now, this is just mind-blowingly exciting.
Yeah, why? Of course, when you think curling, you think of Jacksonville, Florida. And that's actually kind of... That's actually kind of one of the hooks here. And from
what
I'm told,
they go together.
Well, you know, listen, if you spend your entire life on an ice sheet somewhere and you have the chance to come to Jacksonville, you'd take it.
In February.
Yes, in February. So I think this should be a good economic driver. But also, I think it's going to be, curling is not a mainstream sport, but it is an Olympic sport.
Yes, it is.
And I'm also told it is good with a cold beverage.
Really?
Yes. So I think.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, you're
they
sitting.
They just
you
go together.
You got to warm up somehow. If you're going to keep your spirits up, you got to drink the spirits down. Yes.
I guess so.
This is coming to Jacksonville in February, as you mentioned. We'll talk more about this next year, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun to kind of follow that and learn some of the personalities of the folks involved there.
It's its own little subculture.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you don't have a lot of sports that include a broom.
Well, it's been a great year all year having you every Monday, Cole Pepper. You have livened up the show every week, and we so appreciate your participation and your professionalism. Thanks so much for being with us all year long.
Thanks so much, Melissa.
And have a good holiday.
Same to you.
And follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper for all the latest sports news of the First Coast. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Send your emails with questions and comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and make sure to catch the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. See you then.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.